Doris Kearns Goodwin is our guest here on The Paula Gordon Show, Conversations with People at the Leading Edge. Bill Russell, my co-host, of course, is here as well. The business about context, one of the things that you had me thinking about with the team of rivals, somebody, it maybe was Frederick Douglass, but somebody, Frederick Douglass says of Lincoln that he is not only good, he is great. And this business of good and great being a yes and. It's also important to say that someone else was saying that he would always have been a good man. Had he not been in this time frame, this context, he might not have been a great man. So it sort of solves that great man problem. Yes and.
No, I think you're absolutely right. In fact, Lincoln himself worried as a young man when he gave that great speech to the Lyceum that his generation did not have the challenges that the founding fathers had, and they'd be left with modest ambitions because this whole experiment had already been created. And Thomas Mann, the author, said, you know, if you're depending on the times in which you are born, you are either stifled or given great opportunities to do something. So there's no question that the times needs to create the challenge. I remember my husband, who worked for John Kennedy, said that they used to talk about, could he be a great president without a war? Do you need that huge challenge? And Teddy Roosevelt, it was said, was always furious that he somehow didn't have his war to do something with as president.
Yes, he did. It was called the Gilded Age.
Well said. Exactly so. So you need the challenge, but then you need to be up to the challenge, obviously.
Well, and it's why history matters. I find myself going, the more history I read, the more, in a sense, offended I am by how little I had access to or provided to myself access. But what is taught in school, and I would like to believe it's gotten better. My fear is it may have even gotten worse. But the caricatures, the comic strips that pass for history, going back to the sense of context, that is the context in which we live, our history. And being ignorant of that history seems to me to be just stunningly dangerous, particularly in a democracy.
Oh, with no question about that. You know, when Roosevelt was giving one of his great speeches, the
Franklin?
Map speech.
Franklin?
Franklin D. Roosevelt in 1942, after we'd lost at Pearl Harbor and lost all these battles in the Pacific. And he called on history as a solace for the American people. He said, I know this is a difficult time now, and you're going to feel like this war is going to go on for a long time, and it will, but we've been through difficult times before. And then he recreated what it was like for Washington at Valley Forge, losing the supplies and somehow managing to last, what it was like in the early days of the Civil War, the pioneers going over the Rocky Mountains, all of which made the people in his generation realize other generations have dealt with challenges. There's something in the American spirit that will allow us to get through this World War II. But they don't talk that way anymore. I mean, how often do you hear history brought up in presidential speeches?
How
Lyndon
often?
Johnson did it in 65 for Voting Rights Act, but not very much since then.
How often do you hear anybody talk about hope or faith? I mean, some of these things that humans just have, we have to have hope, we have to have faith. We have to have love. Now, certain traditions codify that pretty nicely, but one can either choose to or not come to that from a religious perspective. The human animal requires hope, or how do you get up in the morning?
Absolutely.
We require faith, or how would you possibly do anything without that sense? We have to, and Lincoln as a source of love is just extraordinary and perhaps exemplary. His forgiveness, his compassion, and he is sorely tempted at every turn not to do that.
Oh, absolutely. You know, interestingly, when you talk about faith and hope, I mean, one of the things that so intrigued me was that every time a battle was lost, he immediately, the next hour, if he could, got onto a boat or got onto a train to visit the troops, because he knew somehow if he could walk amidst their decimated ranks, if he could visit the wounded in the hospital, it would give the soldiers hope that he still believed in them. But more importantly, it would give him hope because their energy would get back to him. He could then go back to the White House and give a talk in which he said, "We will prevail." He had faith in these guys who were giving their lives for the cause of the country.
And he wasn't chicken. His own courage to go walk at the front lines, this was a man of real courage. This wasn't a chicken hawk. This was somebody who was there, scared his secretaries pretty right. badly.
Well, he was so tall that, of course, he was a target as he stood there with that stovepipe hat
and
in the line of fire.
Didn't slow him down.
Absolutely.
This courageousness, this is the real thing. And he never said, I'm courageous. He just went out and did it.
No, that's right. I mean, there's that one moment when Oliver Wendell Holmes, who, of course, becomes the Supreme Court Justice, you know, doesn't realize it's him and just says, get down, you fool. What are you doing up there?
And Lincoln thought that was pretty funny.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a wonderful combination that these two meet at that moment.
And all the way through. I was amazed at all the things I didn't know about Lincoln. I grew up in the land of Lincoln. I have a real sense of, I sort of own a piece of Lincoln because I was born in Illinois and grew up there.
Yeah, people feel special about that, don't they?
Oh, yeah. And yet all the things I didn't know about him that you bring out, things like, I didn't know that he got to walk around in Richmond and sit in Jefferson Davis's chair. I had no idea. I didn't know that he was out on the... Again, as Bill talks about all the things we don't know, I needed to know that. I need to know that. I need to know what a real president does.
Well, you know, what was so lucky for me in a way was that by widening the lens to include Seward and Stanton and Chase and Bates, there was much more material than was generally used in a lot of the Lincoln biographies because they all kept diaries. They wrote thousands of letters to their families. And even in the Seward family archives, 5,000 letters that he wrote to his wife and his daughter. And that's where you get all these details that I think allow you to create what it was like to live side by side with these people at that time. You know, too many historians, I know in the 19th century, men historians would hardly mention that their figure had even a wife, much less a child. And yet, if you're going to try and let people now live back in that time, you need the families to be part of the story, too. And because they had such interesting families, I loved Seward's wife. She was an intellectual, brilliant woman, way ahead of her time. And like so many of those 19th century women, suffered from the vapors and the frailties, these undisclosed illnesses, I think because of the frustration of talent. The daughter, 16, wanting somehow to be a writer and not marrying, since she didn't think you could combine both, keeping a fabulous diary from 16 to 21, and then dying at 21, but the diary lasts. So all of those sources are what allowed, I think, me to get some insight into what it would have been like to be by Lincoln's side, because they were, and then they would write about it in gossip and in drama to their children or their families.
Which brings us, of course, to Mary Lincoln, speaking of cartoon characters. Thank you for introducing me to Mary Todd Lincoln. I had never met Mary Todd Lincoln, all those things I thought I knew. This is a very interesting woman.
Yeah, I think what happened is that we all knew too much about the sad ending to her life and the fact that she was somewhat of a manic depressive and the fact that she had lost 3 out of 4 children. I mean, anybody would be sad. One child at 3, her favorite child, Willie, in World War II, in the Civil War, at 10 years old. Tad, her youngest child at 18. She sees her husband killed by her side, and then her oldest son does put her in an asylum in those last years of her life. So somehow that got overlaid on her. Whereas what you could see when you started going back to the early days of their romance is that she was pretty interesting, feisty and smart and intellectual, loved poetry, loved politics.
Fluent French.
Yeah, and so I understood why he fell for her in the first place.
The idea of somebody falling for Lincoln, A, he's funny looking, but this kind of a great character, what kind of a woman would he marry, would he choose? She choose him, he choose her. That was inaccessible before this.
Well, and the love he lost,
right?
Also,
well, I heard about Anne Hutchinson, but that was so. Then Mary's just sort of, oh well, it's not Anne Hutchinson.
Anne Rutledge.
I'm sorry. That would be Anne Rutledge.
There is an Anne Hutchinson, though. Maybe he was involved with her, too. And maybe you made a huge discovery.
Had big, big passions. Wrong person, Paula.
Next book. You've just figured out what I'm going to write about next.
Okay, let's talk about the other Anne.
No, but I think, you know, what happened is that the guy who was Lincoln's law partner, William Herndon, really never liked Mary. They never got along well. So he's the one who gave a big lecture after Lincoln died that Anne Rutledge was the love of Lincoln's life. So for a while, people downgraded that and thought it was just his being biased against Mary. But new scholarship has shown in the last decade or so, there's so many oral histories that talk about Anne Rutledge and Lincoln. Clearly something happened between those two. And I suppose when your first love dies, when you're young, it probably is something that will last through your life. I'm not sure that he had that passion for Mary, but he certainly had a strong feeling for her. And when that family came along, the family gave him, He never had a family life for so long since losing his mother at an early age. She gave him stability. She believed in him. She pressured him. She pushed him. Not that he needed pushing, but she believed in him. And I think she needs to be treated more kindly than she has so far.
In some ways, she is the real surprise in this book. And, you know, I expected you to find, you know, a Lincoln and extract him and see something emerge. And it was surprising what you actually found. But even more surprising was Mary Lincoln, Mary Todd Lincoln, partly because she appears, for all the challenges, to have been a major asset to him.
Oh, no question.
In his presidency, and nobody talks about that.
Yeah, I mean, during the presidency, she just got skewered, I think, because the Northerners didn't trust her because she had four Confederate stepbrothers in the Army. In the Confederate Army, exactly. And the Southerners, of course, thought she's a traitor by being married to Lincoln. The Easterners think she's some sort of awkward Westerner. So there was no footing for her to get, I think, when she got to the White House. But she embarked on two really important projects. One, it wasn't just a silly redecoration of the White House. It was the idea that the White House needed to be spoofed up, whatever the word is, in order to...
Spiffed.
Spiffed is the word.
Spruced or pine.
It needed to be fixed up.
That's it.
In order to be a symbol that the Union was still strong, just as they were keeping the Capitol Dome under construction, just as Congress was paying a lot of money to get itself worthwhile. But people looked down on it as a frivolous project at a time when soldiers didn't have enough money for their blankets. But the other thing that I found out that she did, and unfortunately she didn't allow publicity to attend it, was to go to visit the wounded in the hospital. That had to be so hard. Just in reading the diary entries of Louisa May Alcott or Walt Whitman, who were there, you know, you'd walk in and there'd be whole buckets of arms and legs out there. The stench was terrible. The pain was horrible. And yet a lot of women or men were not able to deal with it. And she went quite often. She just didn't allow reporters to follow her. I think her whole reputation might have been different had she allowed that.
But she didn't let it stop her.
No, she didn't. She kept going, and she wrote letters for these soldiers home to their wives and their husbands. So it was not their husbands, their wives.
Well, my first exposure to the Civil War, I had a grandfather who lived right down the road from Shiloh, actually just outside of Corinth, on the road between Shiloh and Corinth.
Mississippi.
And Shiloh, as I think most people know, was one of the really nasty,
absolutely,
probably the really nastiest first really nasty battle of the war, though none of them were much fun. And my second exposure was the Smithsonian. All the bones that had ended up in the Smithsonian with bullets, the amputated limbs.
Oh, I haven't seen that. Oh, my goodness.
Well, you know, I'm 6-8 years old and wandering through there, and I think I'm going to a museum and end up just cases and cases and cases of, at least that's my recollection of it, maybe three.
No, but as a little kid, it might have seemed that way.
It seemed that way. And just, you know, many, showing the damage that was done by these, because these were huge bullets by and large. I mean, low velocity, and they did horrible damage when they hit. And we've sterilized war. It's still hideous, but this was from, if you were wounded in that war, it was going to be pretty awful.
Absolutely. I mean, and then what could they do if they amputate your leg and they don't have the anesthesia? I mean, it's still an astonishing. The idea of the loss that the country sustained still staggers me. I mean, somebody said that the 600,000 lives that were lost would be equivalent today to 5 million lives. I mean, how could we possibly bear something like that? And yet they did.
Doris Kearns Goodwin tells us how they did it. Under the leadership of an extraordinary individual and some extraordinary people with whom he was identified, Abraham Lincoln and his team of rivals. Be with us when we return in a moment with The Paula Gordon Show.